The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
When I woke up today and found frost perched on the town, it hovered in a frozen sky and gobbled summer down. When the sun turns traitor cold and shivering trees are standing in a naked row, I get the urge for going seem to go, and I get the urge for going when the meadow grass is a turning brown, summertime is a falling down, winter's closing in. I had a boy in the summertime with summer colored skin. Faces in the snow, he got the urge for going and had to let him go. And I get the urge for going when the meadow grass is a turning brown, summertime is a falling down, winter's closing in. Warriors of winter give a cold triumphant shout. All that stays is dying, and all that lives is getting out. See the geese in chevron flight, flapping and racing on before the snow. Got the urge for going, they've got the wings to go. And I get the urge for going when the meadow grasses are turning brown, summertime is a falling down, winter's closing in. So apply the fire with kindling, the blanket to my chin. I'll lock the vagrant winter out and bolt my wandering in. I'd like to call back summertime and have her stay for just another month or so. But she's got the urge for going, guess she'll have to go. And she gets the urge for going when the meadow grasses are turning brown, all her empires are falling down, winter's closing in. And I get the urge for going when the meadow grasses are turning brown, time is a falling down, winter's closing in.
Good morning. I love that song, and I want to thank our own Christine Perry for recording our prelude, Urge for Going, by Joni Mitchell. Welcome to Thomas Paine UU Fellowship. We're located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania, but this morning, thanks to the magic of Zoom and the internet, we are as close as your home. We're a Unitarian Universalist congregation dedicated to nurturing the spirit and transforming the world. I'm Preston Lutweiler, President of the Board of Trustees, and I want to personally welcome you this morning, wherever you are in your life journey, wherever you are in your spiritual journey. Whomever you love, whatever your gender identity or expression, we welcome you into our ever-expanding circle of compassion and caring. If you're visiting us today, you'll notice in the Zoom chat a link to our virtual visitor card. This is a way for you to connect with us and us with you, so please fill it out at any time during the service. Thank you. Our service this morning is inspired by the autumnal equinox. Growing up in New England and Pennsylvania, autumn was always my favorite season. I loved the changing colors of the leaves, the harvest festivals, the crisp air, bonfires. I used to love the smell of burning leaves. Remember that? Some of you may never experience that, and for the sake of our air quality, that's probably a good thing. But it was part of my childhood. This autumn is a time of transition and reflection, and it's marked by the autumnal equinox, which falls this year on September 22nd. The Soul Matters theme for September is embracing possibility. And as we emerge from the disaster of a global epidemic, it's helpful to reflect this autumn on how we and our congregation and our world are emerging from this experience. Rebecca Solnit wrote in April 2020 an article for a podcast for The Guardian titled "The Impossible Has Already Happened: What the Coronavirus Can Teach Us About Hope." In it, she wrote, "A disaster, which originally meant ill-starred or under a bad star, changes the world and our view of it. Our focus shifts, and what matters shifts. What is weak breaks under new pressure. What is strong holds. What was hidden emerges. Change is not only possible, we are swept away by it. We ourselves change as our priorities shift, as intensified awareness of mortality makes us wake up to our own lives and the preciousness of life. Even our definition of we might change as we are separated from schoolmates or coworkers, sharing this new reality with strangers. Our sense of self generally comes from the world around us, and right now, we are finding another version of who we are." Solnit continues with an analogy that I think is perfect for autumn. She writes, "When a caterpillar enters a chrysalis, it dissolves itself, quite literally, into liquid. In this state, what was a caterpillar and will be a butterfly is neither one nor the other. It's a sort of living soup. Within this living soup are the imaginal cells that will catalyze its transformation into winged maturity. May the best among us, the most visionary, the most inclusive, be the imaginal cells. For now, we are in the soup. The outcome of disasters is not foreordained. It's a conflict, one that takes place while things that were frozen, solid, and locked up become open and fluid, full of both the best and the worst possibilities." The phenomenon of metamorphosis is one that Linda Weaver knows well. She's been raising and releasing monarch butterflies for the past month, up to almost 50 as of today. And she shared this amazing process with our kids' club several weeks ago. And it's even more amazing when one considers that these fragile creatures migrate thousands of miles to Mexico, where they overwinter and produce a new generation that will return next summer. How they get the urge for going and how they know from generation to generation where to go inspires awe for our natural world and hope for our future. Linda will now read our chalice lighting words, "The Door Swung Wide," by Reverend Scott Taylor.
Good morning. As so much closed, we were opened. Normal was taken, but it was also turned inside out. Very little is inevitable. Most of it is a choice. This is what we have learned. So now the question comes, do we really want to go back? We can weave a new world, friends. The straw can be spun into gold. A door has swung wide with possibility trying to pull us through. And what of today? Might it be our first step? And now Preston will light the chalice and then the peace lamp.
After I light the peace lamp, your response will be, "And with all the people of the world." May peace be with us.
And with all the people of the world.
Our gathering song today is hymn number 1052, "The Oneness of Everything," with words and music by Jim Scott, who was with us several weeks ago for one of our services. After the gathering song, Ann Rostowski will present a conversation through story with a simple explanation of the equinox and a song in praise of autumn.
Years just might I know. my soul as a song to sing of the oneness of
So now we're going to see a short video explaining what the autumnal equinox is. And after that, I'm going to ask you all to stand up. We can't sing, but we can clap for the song.
Every spring and every fall, the calendar marks the equinox, and you may ask, what is an equinox? The word equinox comes from two Latin words that mean equal and night. During an equinox, the length of the day and the length of the night are approximately the same, about 12 hours each. Because the Earth's axis is tilted, the length of a day changes during the course of a year, with the longest stretch of daylight in midsummer and the shortest day falling in midwinter. During the equinox, the line of sun and shadow on the Earth, dividing night from day, runs directly north and south, the only times in the year it will do so. Equinoxes are directly related to the changing of the seasons. The vernal equinox in March marks the beginning of spring in the northern hemisphere and the beginning of autumn in the southern hemisphere. The autumnal equinox in September marks the beginning of fall in the northern hemisphere and the beginning of spring in the southern hemisphere.
Please stand up. And get ready to clap. For humoring me. You did a good job.
Okay, thank you very much, Anne, for that conversation through story. And that was a simple 1 minute explanation for something that took humanity centuries to figure out. Animals, plants, and ancient humans have evolved to take cues from the cycles of the sun and moon, which we now understand well to be controlled by the orbit of the moon around the Earth and the orbit of the Earth around the sun. The cycles of the seasons govern behavior of plants and animals like the monarch butterfly. They were followed by our early human ancestors and inspired many stories and myths. Religious leaders became the makers and the keepers of calendars based on these cycles to which religious rituals were tied. In the northern hemisphere, the autumnal equinox was associated with harvest festivals and with preparation for the winter, while the winter solstice was a time for the shamans and priests to reassure the followers that the sun would indeed come back. Some early civilizations, like the Maya, used calendars based solely on counting days. The main Mayan calendar counted the equivalent of a year as 18 cycles of 20 days, 20 days each for a total of 360 days. Far enough off of the astronomical year to quickly get out of sync with the seasons. In the Mayan calendar, years in turn were counted in cycles of 20, with a grand cycle consisting of 20 cycles of 20 cycles of 20 cycles of years for a grand total of 8,000 Mayan years, or about 7,885 years. The Maya believed that at the conclusion of the grand cycle, the universe would be destroyed and recreated. No more days in the calendar. You've got to start over, right? Sounds a little bit like the predicted Y2K apocalypse, right? Remember a few years ago the hype about the Mayan calendar predicting that the imminent end of the universe? Well, relax. Historical research and careful calculation puts the end of the present grand cycle of the Mayan calendar at October 12th, 4772. And if you users are still around then, I would hope that they would pay no mind to ancient predictions based on this calendar. Today, we all understand that the explanation in the 1 minute video that Anne played. However, in the past, many religious leaders insisted that both the moon and the sun revolved around the earth, and developed all kinds of stories and religious explanations for the observed changing phases of the moon and the progression of the sun in the sky through the seasons. Centuries of work by Tycho Brahe, Copernicus, Galileo, and Newton, who were searching for truth and meaning and led to our understanding of orbits of the planets and the force of gravity that holds the planets in their orbits. And although Brahe, Copernicus, Galileo, and Newton lived long before Unitarianism even existed, many UUs might claim that they were all at least honorary UUs for their commitment to our fourth principle, the responsible search for truth and meaning. Even into the 18th century, at the dawn of the Age of Reason, the modern calendar was not cast in stone. Thomas Paine's life spans an important date in 1752, when September 2nd on the Julian calendar suddenly became September 14th on the Gregorian calendar. This happened in Britain and in the British colonies. Thus, Thomas Paine's date of birth was recorded as January 29th, 1737 by the Julian calendar in effect on that date in Thetford, England. And on the Gregorian calendar that we use today, the date was really February 9th. And I would argue that that is the date on which paniacs like me should observe his birthday. Everyone agrees that he died in New York, June 8th, 1809, long after the 752 change in the calendars. Whatever calendar they used, human beings, maybe with the exception of the Maya, have pinned their calendars and religious holidays and ceremonies to planetary solstices and equinoxes. Mabon, I think I got that right, is a pagan holiday celebrating the autumnal equinox, and Anne Rostowski is going to tell us a little bit about Mabon.
Hello again. There are different pronunciations of it. I use Mabon, so slightly different than Preston. One of Unitarian Universalist's sources is Earth-centered traditions. Pagans follow the wheel of the year. 4 points on that wheel are the summer and winter solstices, say that 3 times, solstices, and the vernal and autumnal equinoxes. Mabon celebrates the autumnal equinox. It is a celebration of the second harvest. Many civilizations have celebrated a harvest festival around the equinox. For example, in the 1700s, the Bavarians, a part of present-day Germany, began such a festival that starts the last week of September into October. Many of you may be familiar with it, Oktoberfest. We've celebrated it here at the fellowship in the past. Many cultures see this as a time for giving thanks. It is when farmers know how well their summer crops did. They give thanks for food. The name Mabon comes from the Welsh god who is the son of the Earth Mother goddess. Apples may be used in rituals to thank the gods for a bountiful harvest. The apple is the symbol of the fruit harvest. It is a symbol for life, immortality, for healing, renewal, regeneration, and wholeness. It is associated with beauty, long life, and restored youth. For pagans, the apple contains a secret. I'm going to demonstrate that to you. And this is something that Roz Wealth, hopefully she's listening, has done in the past. You take an apple and you cut it widthwise. And what is revealed is a star. The cornucopia, or horn of plenty, is another traditional symbol for Mabon. It is a wonderful symbol for the wealth of the harvest. Some might perform rituals to restore balance and harmony in their lives, as the holiday celebrates a day with equal parts of night and day. Others set up an altar with symbols of the season, such as apples, grapes, and other seasonal items. And there is generally feasting with family and friends. At the equinox, night and day are of equal length and perfect equilibrium. Dark and light, masculine and feminine, inner and outer, all in balance. But we are also on the cusp of transition in which the year begins to wane and darkness begins to defeat the light. The sun's power is waning. From now on, the nights grow longer and the days are shorter and cooler. The sap of trees returns to the roots deep in the earth, changing from the green of summer to the fire of autumn, the flaming reds, oranges, and golds. So Mabon is a celebration, but it is also a time of rest after the labor of the harvest. In terms of life path, it is the moment of reaping what you have sown. Time to look at your hopes and inspirations from the spring. Reflect on how they manifested. It is time to complete projects, to clean out, I have to do that, and to let go of that which is no longer wanted or needed as we prepare for winter, a time for reflection and peace. And it is time to plant seeds of new ideas and hopes, which will be dormant but nourished in the dark until the return of spring, embracing possibilities. And now I will turn it over to Gail Sayre, who will talk about Sukkot.
Thank you, Anne. The Hebrew or Jewish calendar attempts to simultaneously synchronize months with the moon and years with the seasons. This gets rather complicated, and for that reason, I will not get into the details here. Instead, I'm going to talk about what I was taught long ago was the Jewish harvest celebration, Sukkot, which begins tomorrow. As you'll soon hear, Celebrating the harvest is only one part of this unique holiday. Rosh Hashanah, on September 7th of this year, marked the beginning of the Hebrew year, 5782. Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, occurs on the ninth day of the new year, or September 16th this year. Another holiday, Sukkot, begins on the 15th day of the month of Tishrei, the first month of the year on the Hebrew calendar. It is a seven-day holiday, who knew, that this year begins at sundown on September 20th and ends at nightfall on September 27th. The word Sukkot means booths and refers to temporary shelters. The holiday commemorates the 40-year period during which the children of Israel were wandering in the desert, living in temporary shelters. It is also a harvest festival, sometimes referred to as the Festival of Ingathering. This ties in nicely with the theme of our service last week. Sukkot is prescribed in Leviticus 23:33. It is one of three biblically mandated festivals on which Jews were commanded to make a pilgrimage to the temple in Jerusalem. No work is permitted on the first and second days of the holiday, which, as an aside, is why in the past I always thought Sukkot was a two-day holiday. I didn't realize it was 7 days. There are detailed religious specifications for the construction of a sukkah, which is the singular of Sukkot, that I won't get into. Jews are commanded to dwell in the sukkah during the holiday, but this commandment can be fulfilled by eating meals in the sukkah. The harvest holiday aspect of Sukkot is much like our Thanksgiving. Families are encouraged to decorate their sukkah, and in America, many do so using typical fall decorations of gourds, pumpkins, and corn stalks. Sukkot was probably the biblical basis on which the pilgrims modeled the first Thanksgiving. On this holiday, the Torah reading is from Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes 3:1-8 is one of the more recognizable readings from the Old Testament, and the words are the basis for our postlude today, turn, turn, turn. To everything there is a season and a time for every purpose under heaven. A time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up that which is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to get and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to rend and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time of war and time of peace. Now, I certainly don't do this poem the same justice as the birds do in their rendition, so stay tuned for the postlude where you'll hear that. And now I'll turn it back to Preston.
So I hope you can all hear the common thread in these many religious holidays and observances, from Mabon to Oktoberfest to Sukkot. Some things are universal, and that's the part of our religion that I really like, is the universalism of our religion. And when we talk about calendars and anniversaries, on this day, September 19th, as Unitarian Universalists, we can commemorate a very important event that occurred in 1836, 185 years ago. Ralph Waldo Emerson, Frederick Henry Hedge, Bronson Alcott, James Freeman Clark, Converse Francis, gathered at the home of Sophia George and George Ripley in Concord, Massachusetts, for a symposium that Ralph Waldo Emerson had called for to discuss theological and moral subjects freely. The group, officially known as the Transcendental Club, gathered 30 times between 1836 and 1840, whenever Hedge could make it down from to Boston from Bangor, Maine, where he was serving the Unitarian congregation there. The group grew to include Henry David Thoreau, Nathaniel Hawthorne, Theodore Parker, and Margaret Fuller, among others whose names are familiar to Unitarian Universalists. The religious traditions carried from the New World to Europe were, for many in early 19th century America, stale and broken. Even the practices of the Unitarian Church in Boston, dominated by ministers at Harvard and Cambridge, were stifling to the members of the Transcendental Club. Thomas Paine's Age of Reason had helped set the stage for questioning of religious authority and dogma in America. The luminaries of the Transcendental Club also had access to new translations of major religious writings from the East, including Hindu, Taoist, and Buddhist texts. They were part of a theological revolution in which direct observation of the natural world informed a responsible search of truth and meaning beyond the Bible and established religious authority, and celebrated what has become our seventh principle of the modern UU faith, respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. The American and French revolutions had ushered in more democratic notions in both politics and religion. Popes and bishops were out, along with kings and emperors. The discussions and writings of the Transcendental Club were also fundamental to the sixth principle of our modern UU faith, the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and in society at large. So let us celebrate today, September 19th, as the anniversary of the Transcendental Club that laid the foundation for our UU 4th, 6th, and 7th principles. And now I would like to invite you all to participate in a meditation with our hymn number 1009, Meditation on Breathing, by Sarah Dan Jones, performed by Mary Pratt and Jim McGaw at the UU Church of South Hills in Pittsburgh. As you breathe, feel your place in this universe and in the continuum of time. Contemplate the interdependent web of life of which we are particularly reminded at this time of year, and consider what you can do to put back together in a new, better form the pieces of your life, our congregation, and the world.
Breathe out, breathe in, breathe out.
When I breathe in, I breathe in peace. When I breathe out, I'll breathe out love.
When I breathe in,
I'll breathe in peace.
When I breathe out,
come to the part in our service where you may share a joy or concern with all of us. We'll call on those in the sanctuary first to come up to the microphone to share their brief joy or concern. Then Mike McNeil will instruct those on Zoom in using the raise hand function to be recognized, and then we'll unmute anyone who is joining by phone to give them an opportunity to share. While you're gathering your thoughts, please listen to a musical interlude to See a World. The words are by William Blake, set to music arranged by Edvard Grieg. Blake was a contemporary of Thomas Paine, although 20 years younger. The men had met and corresponded. In 1989, Jack Shepherd wrote a play, In Lambeth, centered on a fictional meeting between Blake and Paine in 1791. The title is from a line in Blake's poem, Jerusalem. There is a grain of sand in Lambeth that Satan cannot find. Grieg is probably most famous for In the Hall of the Mountain King, and which I remember our teacher playing in my first grade music class at Buckingham Friends School. Linda and I had the pleasure to visit Edvard Grieg's home in Bergen, Norway, which is now a museum, and we got some idea of the natural beauty that inspired his music.
In a grain of sand, and a heaven in a wildflower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, and eternity.
A world in a grain of sand, and a heaven in a wildflower. Hold infinity in the palm of your hand, and eternity in an hour.
To bring this time of sharing to a close by singing Spirit of Life. It will come up here on the screen momentarily.
It was a very moving service. I thank you all who participated and made it possible. We'd like to close our service today with words from Parker Palmer in his book, Healing the Heart of Democracy, The Courage to Create a Politics Worthy of the Human Spirit, which was published in 2011, well before the challenges we've faced recently. As a side note, I'd just like to mention that I was fortunate to live in community with Parker back in the 70s, and he's a wonderful person. I highly recommend this book. Parker writes, if American democracy fails, the ultimate cause will be not a foreign invasion or the power of big money or the greed and dishonesty of some elected officials or a military coup or the internal communist, socialist, fascist takeover that keeps some Americans awake at night. It will happen because we, you and I, became so fearful of each other, of our differences, and of the future that we unraveled the civic community on which democracy depends, losing our power to resist all that creates it and call it back to its highest form. Parker Palmer. C.S. Lewis once wrote, "You cannot go on indefinitely being just an ordinary, decent egg. We must be hatched or go bad. Let us hope that there is still time for us to hatch." Now Linda Weaver will help Preston extinguish the chalice.
Thank you, Larry. I'm going to extinguish the chalice with the words of the amazing Manda Gorman, who was the National Youth Poet Laureate and the youngest inaugural poet in US history. I remember watching her live, and it was a great day and a great poem. The Hill We Climb. Every breath from my bronze-pounded chest, we will raise this wounded world into a wondrous one. We will rebuild, reconcile, and recover. Our people, diverse and beautiful, will emerge, battered and beautiful. The new dawn blooms as we free it, for there is always light. If only we're brave enough to see it, if only we're brave enough to be it. We extinguish the flame of this chalice, but not its light, which we will take with us into the world, for there is always light. If only we are brave enough to see it and to be it.
And now our closing song is hymn number 1064, Blue Boat Home, produced for the UU Church of Palouse, Moscow, Idaho. Lyrics will appear on the video. The tune is a Welsh hymn composed by Roland Hugh Pritchard in 1830, before he was 20 years old, and first published in a songbook called The Singer's Friend in 1844. Notice that he wrote it 6 years before, and it was published 8 years after the first meeting of the Transcendental Club. Peter Mayer wrote the lyrics to highlight the beauty of our lovely planet. The song nicely illustrates our seventh principle of respect for the interconnected web of life of which we are a part.
Still my Sky, my sea.